This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor at the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout as we talk our favorite topic, which is politics, Brandon. Lots going on. Let's start off with the Democrats, our favorite, not sometimes favorite topic. The DNC's made some big changes in terms of rules. They have essentially kind of eliminated superdelegates in the presidential nomination process, at least on the first ballot. What's going on?
Yeah, so for people who aren't aware, superdelegates are basically this sort of supernumerary individuals who have a vote independent of what occurs at the primary level at the states during the nomination phase. The criticism was that basically they are kind of the elites of the party. The irony is that that's what they were supposed to be, right? Like they were supposed to be built-in kind of fail-safes for a lack of trust that the Democrats had of most of the people that were voting. So what the DNC has decided to do is to scale this back. Essentially now the superdelegates are extremely limited. The procedures allow for superdelegates to vote for whomever they want if it's the case that a candidate's not nominated on the first ballot. So I think this is a fairly big change. I mean, obviously, in one level, the rules make the outcome. The Bernie Sanders folks were unhappy with the Clinton folks because Clinton had already kind of sewed up all the superdelegates, giving her, like, essentially the win before any voting occurred. So I think this is kind of a win for insurgent candidates, not just the Sanders folks in this case who represent that, but I think more broadly, this could help a candidate who wants to make a kind of dark horse run.
Yeah, I think this is just about the perception rather than the reality, because as a practical matter, the superdelegates have not been determining who was the nominee. They certainly weren't under Clinton the first time or Obama in the previous two times. So I think it's a little bit of kind of a show here. But it is, I think, a larger trend of wanting to allow the citizens and the voters to have their choice count more. The optics are good. And so, you know, we'll move on and be happy with the outcome of it. But I think in general, it's a little bit more than anything. I'm just more disappointed. I kind of thought these superdelegates were delegates who could fly in the air or something
like that. They've been stripped of their capes. They can no longer fly, right? Unless nobody gets the first ballot nomination. I think this could happen. I mean, the Democratic Party is going through major changes. There's a lot of kind of upheaval inside. We've seen this in some of the primaries. So it could be that these rule changes do have a pretty significant effect on the nomination phase when 2020 rolls around, which is like right around the corner, right?
I kind of feel like that's wishful thinking on our part. We always talk about broker conventions.
Yeah, right.
And
sizzle, right?
Exactly. But we'll see. We'll see if it happens. Well, speaking of elections and nominating processes, we had a huge election, kind of a potentially earth-shattering election.
Yeah, our neighbors to the south, right?
Exactly. Mexico. Andrés Manuel López Obrador was elected president of Mexico. He's actually the first person ever elected outside of the major party structure, not unlike what happened in France not too long ago. But he is what they call a leftist populist or leftist nationalist. Mm-hmm. Our friend Geronimo Cortina likes to say that he ran on making Mexico great again.
That's funny. Yeah. Did he have a hat too? Like an AMLO hat? It lends itself to like that bumper sticker hat politics, right? Yeah. So Mexico's only had serious party competition since 2000, right? When Vicente Fox wrestled party control away from the PRI. I guess the question for me is, you know, what effect this will have. I'm curious to get your take on this. We talked about this on the pod last week. He's made some big promises, right? Major social reforms. He said he's going to fix the drug problem, but he's going to do so with no increase in taxes. Mexico's economic situation is solid but not stellar, and so it makes it difficult for him, I think, to come through on a lot of these promises. And I think it's the case, too, that because it's really going to be a coalition of individual parties, and his party itself only makes up about 5% of the seats, it's going to be hard to get things done, especially if it's going to be kind of too radical in any direction. So I think that's one concern just internally. But in terms of the domestic situation for the U.S., what's your take on where this is going to go, what the effect is going to be on borders, on trade, and everything else?
Yeah, I'd written a piece about this where I think there's a lot of synergies, ironically, between President Trump and AMLO, President López Obrador, in the sense that they both really want similar things. They want an end to the drug war. They want an end to the northern migration, at least from Central Americans. Mm-hmm. They're trying to limit that. And I think there's a greater understanding that economic expansion and opportunity in Mexico is key to that. I think where you're going to see differences is on the wall and elements like that. They both are also similarly skeptical of traditional trade agreements. And so I think it'll be fascinating to see how the negotiations around NAFTA come about. Because what we're probably going to see, I think, are going to be greater linkages of NAFTA, not just for traditional commerce and trade, but I think immigration and issues related to security are along, not just along the border, but issues related to the drug war are definitely going to come into play.
Yeah. Well, Senator Ted Cruz, who's in a tough fight for his own seat, says that, you know, that AMLO is a socialist and he's run an anti-American campaign for a long time since he first started running for president. This is his third try. Do you think that's true, or do you think that this is just posturing from Cruz?
I think it's just posturing from Cruz. I think it allows them to sort of paint him in a picture. I think the reality is this. He's not Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's probably a lot closer to Bernie Sanders than he is anything else.
Yeah.
As you said, I mean, he's sort of a, he's essentially running on an anti-corruption campaign.
Yeah.
And so I'm somewhat skeptical of the comparison of him as a traditional kind of like Latin American dictator, which is what Cruz is alleging.
I think, this election says as much about what's happening in Mexico as what's happening in the U.S., so it's hard to kind of conflate the two. But it's definitely the case that you see some similarities, and as you pointed out.
Well, speaking of trade and NAFTA and all those other things, Brandon, I am crestfallen right now because we are in the real issue is finally coming to fruition here, and that is the potential challenges for the American whiskey industry.
Yes. Exactly.
This is party politics, after all.
That's right. The trade restrictions, some of the levies that China has put on the U.S. and some of the products could potentially hurt the American whiskey market, which is really beginning to boom. Now, I've been a whiskey advocate for a long time, Jay, as you know.
I know.
And so that could be a real kind of cut to our bottom line here. I want to throw one more issue into our little soiree here, and that's about cheese, because some of the byproduct that's used to make cheese is also part of this tariff. It could be that there could be a major effect on the cheese industry. So whiskey and cheese are like, bread and peanut butter. You cannot live without. So we could be in some danger here. But honestly, like the fireworks on the 4th of July aren't even cold yet. And we've already got this kind of discussion of a trade war, which could affect, the heartland of America and Texas in particular on all kinds of issues, right? Meats, you've got pork, soybeans, and we talked about cheese and whiskey. So there's a lot of potential blowback here economically.
Yeah, trade wars are just structurally bad things, right? I mean, we know that there's going to be losers on all sides of this, particularly in this case, businesses that are heavily export driven. Mm-hmm. And so at a time when the American bourbon industry and whiskey industry is seeing a kind of a massive increase in terms of market share, it's a huge blow to places like Kentucky that voted heavily for Donald Trump, Tennessee that voted heavily for Donald Trump. So it's an interesting sort of political dynamic here. But again, it reinforces what we talked about. I think there's a lot of unintended consequences to the trade posturing that the president has put out there. Hopefully, a lot of the rhetoric surrounding it can be dialed down and we can get back to business.
Yeah, it's I think it sounds better as a political argument than the effect will be, and I think it's going to come back to bite them. I was really looking for like a cheese analogy. I couldn't come up with one on the fly, Jay. So maybe you can, right? Or a whiskey analogy, right? Trump is drunk on tariffs. I don't know how to build that in, right?
Yeah. Well, one thing we do know about President Trump is if it was an idea or a project or a program started by President Obama, he just doesn't like it. And so the Department of Education has come out with a new set of guidelines that has effectively retracted Obama-era regulations related to affirmative action, kind of instructing universities to really not care so much about affirmative action and diversity makeup in higher education.
Yeah, it's interesting because this comes on the heels of the retirement of Justice Kennedy, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. And that is a moment for a potential consternation for people who appreciate affirmative action and who support affirmative action, because there's a case working its way through the courts that's individuals, Asian-American individuals, who are suing Harvard essentially for systematically excluding Asian-Americans from attending Harvard. So if that's the case, that this continues, then we could see the end of affirmative action as we know it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you're going to probably see some changes in not just affirmative action, but we talked about it as it relates to the Voting Rights Act and sort of other issues in this category. I think the era of sort of race conscious or ethnically based conscious policy may be on the wane.
Yeah, and UT has said that they don't plan to make any change as a result of this. And UT, of course, is on the front lines when it comes to affirmative action, since they're one of the marquee players in some of the litigation on this issue. So it's interesting that there hasn't been any major change yet. But this court case, if it comes through, and if the new justice, whoever that person is, goes the opposite way of Kennedy, then you're going to see a major sea change. Okay, Jay, well, we're looking for a cheese-based analogy. I've got a cheesy one for you. Here you go. There was a fake phone call, apparently, that got through to the President of the United States from a comedian who was a former Howard Stern sidekick. Jay, what is happening now?
Exactly. Well, the White House switchboard apparently let through a shock jock caller masquerading as Senator Robert Menendez, who, as we know, was recently beat the rap, as they say. Yeah. He was under federal indictment for corruption. Yeah. It went to trial.
A senator corrupt?
Senator corrupt, yeah. He was able to win, to which President Trump, when he got the fake call, congratulated him for winning.
Did he really? Oh, that's horrible. Yeah, it was only a matter of time before this happened, right? At least before it became public. So maybe it's not surprising in a White House that's fairly disorganized, but it's still funny to see even like the most powerful person in the planet being, you know, punk like this. Well, let's switch to Texas, Jay. Let's talk about ICE. There's been a lot of talk in liberal circles about abolishing ICE. What does this mean and where does Beto O'Rourke stand on it?
Well, Brandon, you're right. ICE, it's not the ICE that we put in our whiskey.
Okay.
Is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division of the Department of Homeland Security. Immigration services are basically broken down into three separate areas. Border control and protection deals with folks coming across the border. USCIS, which is Citizenship and Immigration Services, which deals with the applications and processing. Mm-hmm. And Immigration and Customs Enforcement is that third branch that deals with the enforcement elements within the borders of the United States. Mm-hmm. They run the detention centers, or at least they administer the detention centers, and they are the ones that do essentially all of the activities of finding and deporting and or removing folks who are here illegally.
Yeah.
The idea was, and the movement that you're now hearing from Democrats or many progressives, is that ICE itself needs to be disbanded.
Yeah.
And it seems like a far-fetched idea, but it's starting to get some traction among even some potential 2020 candidates. Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, is talking about it. Big issue here, really problematic, because when the issues are about border control, ICE has nothing to do with the border. They have nothing to do with actually making the policies. I think the Democrats are making a huge mistake concentrating on the abolishing a department or a division rather than dealing with the underlying policy. And it's going to hurt some Democrats here in Texas.
Yeah, it seems like they've overreached, right? And I think that the immigration issue was potentially winnable, which normally it's not in a state like Texas. But it could be that they've taken it too far. The agency has become a lightning rod, but it hasn't, I think, really affected all Democrats. We'll see how this plays out in the next couple of weeks. But for Beto O'Rourke in particular, he was a little unsure about whether or not that should happen. He has to walk a kind of fine line between where the National Party is and where many of the sort of more progressive members are, and then the kind of twins in Texas, which are more conservative. But I also think it underscores the fact that O'Rourke is a moderate in that he believes in policy moderation. He's not a flaming partisan in the same way that like other, you know, politicians who are running in this kind of race are, or even like Ted Cruz is, right? He's much more, I think, modest and a lot less explosive. This is a good approach to me to when you're in the Senate, but not necessarily to help you get to the Senate, right? If the base is on the line of wanting to eliminate ICE and O'Rourke is not there, then there could be some pushback. In fact, this very question came up because somebody asked him at a town hall meeting whether or not he thought we should, and then really pushed him to say that he would do it where he wouldn't. But this is something I think that is going to continue to come up and has the potential to kind of throw a wrench back into the debate about immigration.
Yeah, O'Rourke is a border congressman, right? His district is in El Paso, the El Paso region. He understands immigration issues far better than I think not just other his colleagues in Congress, but most people. And so he recognizes that ICE serves a valuable function, that this is a policy question, not an administrative issue here. And it needs to be dealt with, I think, in a reasonable way. This reminds me so much of back in the 80s when Democrats were talking about, you know, unilateral disarmament and the test ban treaty, things that I think would portray them as soft in a negative way. And this has the potential of taking an issue that Democrats were winning on and turning it around and making it a loser for them.
And if you don't make it sexy, then you're not going to get the attention. And O'Rourke's not like that, I think, to his credit. But that's going to be, I think, more difficult for him to really rally the base if the base is moving that direction.
Well, Brandon, we had a congressional special election, CD27, for the seat that was vacated by Blake Farenthold down in the Corpus area. We now have a new congressman, Congressman Michael Cloud. What happened? What does this race tell us? Anything about what we could expect in November?
A little bit. I mean, this is clearly a Republican district. Now, we know that it was drawn in that way. It had, of course, from the court and their ruling, wasn't something that was done intentionally. But it's clear that the partisan balance favors the Republicans. A couple of things I think stand out here. I mean, first of all, it was the case that the Democrats overperformed, but not as well as they had in past specials. So it could be that the tide is not as sort of dramatic as it is in other places here in Texas. But you also had, I think, a weak Democratic candidate. With a stronger Democratic candidate, I think you could potentially see some movement in this district. If you put all the Democrats together, they're at about 40. The Republicans are about, you know, high 50s, right, altogether. So the fact that the Republicans were unified and the Democrats weren't suggests maybe that, you know, in 2020, this race could be one that's on the national competitive cycle. But as it is now, I don't think it will be.
Well, Governor Abbott is making some big waves here. He's now told various departments and agencies of state government that any rules that get put out have to be cleared by his office first. This is a pretty dramatic change, kind of a big centralization of power and authority, because as we know, rulemaking was something that was governed at the departmental and agency level. This is a big shift. What does this tell us, Brandon, about what we can expect from Governor Abbott?
I mean, I'm a politics nerd, so I love rules. And we know that rules oftentimes, you know, give powers to these different individuals, especially the governor in this case. If it's the case that he can use this to be able to check some of the rulemaking that happens at agencies over which he has less control, then it could be really dramatic, right? We're talking about the Texas Commission on Educational or Environmental Quality, Health and Human Services, which has had lots of issues the last couple of years. This gives the governor potential to be able to have say over what these people who he's appointed but then has less control over do with their policies. The attempts to get control over the bureaucracy has long been the unicorn for executives, right? So this would be like amazing if you could actually make this work. It's not clear what the governor will do with the information, but I do think it serves as a kind of warning to the agencies that he's watching, and that may be enough to be able to, you know, jolt them back into place if they were thinking of doing something different.
Well, a few weeks ago, Brandon, you and I think, sat here and probably thought that one of the biggest issues of the midterm cycle would be gun-related, gun control, violence at schools, and in the tragic sort of fallout from Santa Fe shooting. Lieutenant Governor Patrick had made a pledge to donate metal detectors. He has now done that. This is one of those interesting issues that we had almost forgotten about in the lead up because of all the focus now on immigration. But what's going on with Governor Patrick? And does he just have a stash of metal detectors in his garage somewhere? How's
right.
this?
Maybe he makes them. I like to think that they're like Dan Patrick brand, right? Yeah, I think to me this is a nice gesture, but I'm not sure that it's a policy solution. And if it is a policy solution, I'm not sure what he's trying to imply. Is he suggesting this is like what Texas should do to keep the school children safe? How many school children are there in Texas? You know, millions, right? It's in the population of students is more than most states have people, right? We've got something like 8,000 schools, right? So the cost of this could be pretty considerable if this is the where he wants to go. So I'm not sure. What's your take on this?
This was one of those items that Governor Patrick had thought would be, I think, have much more political saliency than it ends up doing. This is just not the focal point anymore. And it's not a practical solution, right? Because there's no real underlying policy to it. There's no funding mechanism to allow schools to be able to purchase these things. This is just sort of a one-time donation.
Unless he's got a lot more.
Unless he's got...
You need a lot more.
So it's just, as a practical matter, I think it's more politics than anything else. And the timing of it, I think, has probably worked against him on that. Well, Brandon, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about the big bombshell out of the Supreme Court, the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy. What's it going to mean going forward? And what is it going to mean potentially in the Texas Senate race?
So, Jay, as you said, the big news of the week was the retirement of Justice Kennedy. He is the swing vote on a lot of cases: affirmative action, abortion, fair housing, solitary confinement. We can go on and on. Now, he says he doesn't swing, the cases swing, but the fact is that he is the kind of most moderate member of the court in that he goes back and forth between the conservative and liberal coalitions. This is a major effect. The president's going to have the ability to be able to replace him, potentially, right? What's going to happen here?
Yeah, well, the president's already come out with a list, you know, the big list that he put out during the campaign. He's sort of honoring that. These are candidates that have been vetted by the Federalist Society and other sort of conservative organizations. Of that, he's already interviewed four current circuit judges and is looking at an additional two others. So we've got a short list of about 4 to 6 people, all of whom are traditional conservative jurists. No matter who you get, it's likely to be someone more conservative than Anthony Kennedy. So you're going to see a rightward tilt in terms of overall rulings in the court. The big question is how this process works itself out. We know about what happened with Merrick Garland when President Obama tried to do this, tried to name him with the death of Antonin Scalia.
Stonewalling, right?
Exactly. The real question is, well, how will the Democrats react? There's already sort of a national movement to try to get Democrats to stop the confirmation process by any means necessary. And I'm not sure they're going to get there because just the rules themselves don't allow for that. So we're probably going to get a justice that is going to be more conservative. The real question is this. This is not Donald Trump's pick. This is going to end up being Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska's pick because they cannot afford to lose a single Republican because John McCain is not able to be there. So you're down to 50 Republicans. You can't lose a single one. If you do, then you're not going to win.
Remember, Justice Gorsuch only got 54 votes. And so I don't know that the appetite to, like, confirm a reasonable-looking jurist is there. As you said, the Democrats are going to push back on this. But the person who gets nominated will be key here. And I think that the kind of blanket pushback from Democrats isn't going to go anywhere. But if they can find something specific with that person, then it could be that we find the real, as Joe Biden used to say, kabuki theater of these nomination hearings. You know that Trump is going to nominate somebody conservative, but the question is, how do they package it, right? It's going to be stealth in a way, because all nominees since Robert Bork's nomination went down in flames for Reagan have been much more circumspect about how they approach their time on the bench. So they can hide their conservatism in sort of neutral language, which is difficult to understand sort of how they'd ultimately rule. So the question then is kind of where the Democrats find traction, right? Will it be on abortion issues? It very well could be. Will it be affirmative action like we talked about? It could be that too. Could it be something else? Could it be something personal? Remember, like, Justice Ginsburg was taken down because he had smoked marijuana at Harvard.
That seems so quaint now, just looking back, right?
Yeah, it feels like a million years ago people cared whether you smoked marijuana at Harvard on the faculty. But that brought him down in the 80s. In fact, that's why we have Justice Kennedy to date. So I think the person matters a lot, and I'm sure the White House knows this. Here's the other thing. This is the biggest decision that the White House will make. This will be the thing that they run on in the midterm. So Gorsuch is one thing. Certainly that's a win for the president. This will be the, I think, icing on that cake.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to remember that while Anthony Kennedy was a swing voter on this court, he is an authentic conservative.
Yes.
And so I think we have to take it with a grain of salt.
Especially in close cases.
Yeah.
He sided with the conservatives much more frequently.
Yeah, much more frequently. And so I think the idea that he was a moderate, I think, has been a little bit overstated. But My sense is that President Trump is going to be careful with who he picks on this.
Yeah.
They want to win. They don't want to lose on that. Yeah. On this pick. And so my guess is that he's going to shy away from someone like Amy Barrett, Justice, who is a former Notre Dame law professor, mm-hmm. has lots of writing as it relates to abortion rights and things, or her opposition to it, and probably pick someone that, as you said, is much more opaque in terms of where their views are.
No paper trail, right?
No paper trail at all.
An easy thing to latch onto.
Yeah,
right?
My dark horse pick is from the Sixth Circuit is Justice Emil Thapper, who would be the first Asian American on the court.
Oh.
He's from Kentucky. He is close to Mitch McConnell, the majority leader. He was the first judicial pick by Donald Trump. It would be an interesting choice for him. He would also, I think, couch and be able to use his status as sort of as a minority, as a bit of a shield for President Trump, and be able to make the case there.
That's a great point. Well, some people have talked about Justice Roberts being the new swing vote. I mean, he will be the most moderate member of the court, at least if you look at like the Quinn Martin scores, which are these ideological pivot scores that people can produce based upon the rulings. On issues like freedom of speech and criminal rights of criminal suspects, he's been pretty liberal, but on a lot of other things, he's been more conservative. His rulings have generally been narrow, I think, as a result of trying to attempt to find some consensus. So I wonder how a more conservative court will function with Roberts as chief, right? Because he wants to preserve the integrity of the court and also have sort of narrow decisions that gain a bigger majority than five. Is that going to make any difference, or is he going to sort of now unleash the dogs of conservatism and simply be every decision, you know, a six decision or a seven decision?
Yeah, that's going to be the real key question. And how this whole process impacts politics, I think, is going to be key. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, Brandon, let's talk about how this is going to affect the Senate races, and in particular, how it's going to affect the Texas Senate race.
So, Jay, obviously this is a blockbuster issue. A replacement of a justice is a major feather in the cap of a president, but if it fails, it could go horribly wrong. It affects all the politics down below it. What's your take on how globally this is going to matter, and then specifically to Texas?
Yeah, I think it's going to matter. I think for Democrats, they have to be careful to oppose without looking like they're obstructing. I think there's a pretty large consensus, at least according to the immediate polling, that people want to have a confirmation process.
Yeah.
They don't want it to be blocked. So I think for someone like Congressman Beto O'Rourke, you're going to have a situation where he's going to have to make a decision on how he's going to challenge on this issue. We know that Ted Cruz is going to talk about this a lot.
Yeah.
He's on the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
He's very good at sort of using these opportunities to highlight his stances. So he's going to be using this for his benefit and kind of push hard against O'Rourke.
It's a great point. You know, Cruz has had some trouble with Trump, and this is an opportunity for him to be able to sidle up to Trump in a way that isn't about the personal, you know, effect that they had during the campaign. So this is a way for Cruz to get close to Trump and whoever Trump chooses. As we said, O'Rourke is not an inflammatory politician. I don't think he's going to be able to push back in a dramatic way on this, and I think that's probably going to be to Cruz's advantage. But generally speaking, in terms of how this plays out, it's hard to know, right? Because it's always been the case that presidents have tried to game the court, and they've often failed, right? That happened for Nixon, right? It happened for Reagan, who appointed O'Connor and Kennedy, thinking there would be a tremendous conservative shift. It happened for Bush, too, who appointed Souter. So it's unclear what will happen of this ultimately. But I do think what will happen is that the court will be more conservative. Then you'll have a period where the court is thwarting a lot of the opinions of popular majorities, like abortion rights, affirmative action issues with respect to incarceration. So it could be then that the court's legitimacy is hurt because you've got the court going one way and the public and Congress going another way. So I think there's a lot of flux in terms of how this is going to play out. And it all frankly hinges on who the president chooses and what Congress decides to do about it.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci. Special kudos to our web team, Giselle Bueno, Matt Prendergast, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the Swing Justice Holstlander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.